This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, February 4, 2004. From the studios of KUNM in Albuquerque, New Mexico, I'm Deepa Fernandez. Donald Rumsfeld has his feet held to the fire over claims of Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. Primary results from yesterday's seven states contest went overwhelmingly in favor of Senator John Kerry. We look at the implications of Tuesday's vote from New Mexico. And could there finally be peace for the Sudan? We have a special FSRN report. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The Massachusetts High Court ruled today that only full and equal marriage rights for gay couples, rather than civil unions, would be constitutional, erasing any doubts that the nation's first same-sex marriages could take place in the state beginning in mid-May. The court issued the opinion in response to a request from the state Senate about whether Vermont-style civil unions, which convey the state benefits of marriage but not the title, would meet Massachusetts' constitutional muster. The four justices who ruled in favor of gay marriage wrote in the advisory opinion that, quote, the history of our nation has demonstrated that separate is seldom, if ever, equal, and that a bill that would allow for civil unions but falls short of marriage makes for unconstitutional, inferior, and discriminatory status for same-sex couples. The much-anticipated opinion sets the stage for next Wednesday's Constitutional Convention, where the legislature will consider an amendment that would legally define marriage as a union between one man and one woman. The soonest a constitutional amendment could end up on the ballot would be 2006, meaning that until then, the High Court's decision will be Massachusetts law, no matter what is decided at the Constitutional Convention. U.S. Republican Congressman Billy Townsend stepped down from his position as the chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. Stephen Lacey has more from Washington, D.C.
According to political watchdog group Common Cause, Congressman Townsend negotiated a job offer with Pharma while considering legislation that directly affected the organization. Pharma supposedly offered Townsend a job as head of their Washington lobbying operation. These allegations raise questions about Townsend's endorsement of the new Medicare prescription drug bill. The controversial $540 billion Medicare bill was criticized for supporting the pharmaceutical corporations and limiting government price restrictions on prescription drugs. Townsend helped write the legislation for the bill, which was passed by Congress last month. Mary Boyle, a spokeswoman for Common Cause, says that his ties to the industry should raise suspicions.
We think this showed a real lack of judgment. I mean, it just raises the question, what has he been doing recently? Has he been doing the people's work, or has he been doing his own work?
Townsend made the decision to step down as chairman after pressure from various political watchdog groups. His resignation will be effective on February the 16th. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Stephen Lacey.
After proposing bigger budgets for defense and homeland security, the White House released a list of the 128 domestic programs facing the axe. Tom Gomez reports from Washington.
The deepest cuts in the new budget are in the protection of the environment, education, and agricultural spending, for example. While the Bush administration has claimed that vocational education is a priority for the federal government, his proposal trims that program by $300 million. Other proposed cuts include dropout prevention programs, literacy programs for prisoners, an arts and education program, and a job training program for migrant and seasonal farm workers. Those cuts are likely to be painful for residents of Washington, D.C., where more than half of all children grow up in poverty. Sincere Ali Shakur operates a breakfast program for hungry children within walking distance of the White House.
Across the United States, they're closing shelters like crazy. They're closing rec centers like crazy. And see, the state knows exactly what they're doing.
You got a bunch of people who have interests in keeping poor people poor and making profit off of it. The game won't change.
That report was prepared by Free Speech Radio News correspondent Tom Gomez. The main minority community in northeastern Sri Lanka observed Independence Day today as a day of mourning to protest and urge Sinhalese political leaders to kickstart the peace process. Ponia Manikavasagam reports from Sri Lanka.
Sri Lankan President Chandrika Kumaratunga and Prime Minister Ranil Wickremesinghe, rival political leaders, jointly participated in the 56th Independence Day celebrations in the capital of Colombo. In her Independence Day speech, the Sri Lankan president said today that negotiations are the only way to jumpstart the stalled peace process. She denied that her actions have in any manner weakened the current peace efforts. For the first time in 6 years, the military displayed multi-barrel rocket launchers and heavy artillery guns in the celebrations. a military spokesman said the display was not meant to intimidate the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam or LTTE. The Liberation Tigers complained that, despite the ceasefire, not enough has been done to rebuild the war-shattered Northern East. Public organizations backed by the rebels in the Northeast have said February 4th is not an independence day for the Tamils, but rather a day of mourning. In the Northeast, shops were closed, transport came to a standstill, black flags were put up in offices, homes and shops in protest. I am Ponnaiya Manikavasagam for Free Speech Radio News in Vavuniya, Sri Lanka.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
Massachusetts Senator John Kerry was the big winner in yesterday's seven state primaries and caucuses to select a Democratic challenger to President Bush. One of the two states that Kerry did not win was South Carolina, which Senator John Edwards won comfortably. New Mexico and Arizona both went to Kerry, and notably they were the first largely Hispanic states to cast their ballots for the Democratic presidential nominee. FSRN's Jeremiah Luria Johnson reports from Albuquerque on the results and implications of Tuesday's vote.
The Democratic Party of New Mexico only expected 10% of its 500,000 voters to participate in Tuesday's caucus. Instead, 20% went to the polls, 40% of them chose John Kerry, 20% Wesley Clark, Howard Dean got 15%, and John Edwards 10%. Kerry's victories in five out of the seven primary states last night could work against him, according to Larry Bensky, national affairs correspondent for Pacifica Radio. Bensky says Kerry could become a casualty of the Democrats' search for conservative voters.
What we need to look at in the next few contests is whether or not John Kerry starts to get painted into the L corner, as in liberal. In yesterday's consultations, there was some sign that that's beginning to happen, and that John Edwards and Wesley Clark are beginning to take the conservative end of the voters who vote in these contests. That's very dangerous for the Democratic Party because it means that they could be split, and of course, Kerry's going to be painted as an extreme liberal anyway.
According to Bensky, it's going to take large voter turnout and outreach to diverse communities for the Democrats to win back the White House in 2004. Democratic Governor Bill Richardson says that with a 42% Latino population, the country is looking at New Mexico as a battleground state for Latino votes.
New Mexico will be a barometer of the Latino vote because the vote here is traditional, it's moderate, it's Hispanics that have been here for many generations. And it's a state that I think generally reflects in the Hispanic community how the Hispanic voter will go nationally. It's important that we keep the Republicans to under 40%. And if they exceed 40%, we're in trouble in key states like New Mexico, Nevada, Arizona, and Florida.
In New Mexico, Democratic candidate Dennis Kucinich had his strongest showing so far with 5% of the state's Democratic vote. Geraldine Bowen, his media director in New Mexico, says his relative success is from early campaigning, as well as from Green Party members who have switched parties to vote Kucinich.
He has the same values and the same positions on issues as the Green Party, basically. So people who are looking toward someone to represent those issues, a lot of them came over to him because of that. And actually, I'm one of them.
Now that the caucus is over, the New Mexico State Democratic Party will focus on the national election to defeat President George W. Bush. In the 2000 presidential election in New Mexico, Democrat Al Gore beat Republican George W. Bush by only 366 votes. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jeremiah Luria Johnson.
Today, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld defended President Bush's 2005 budget proposal to spend $401 billion on the military that, without including spending on Afghanistan and Iraq, makes up 20% of national spending. But what was supposed to be a budget hearing in the Senate Armed Service Committee quickly became an impromptu hearing on weapons of mass destruction, where Rumsfeld fielded questions from skeptical Democrats. Our DC editor Mitch Jeserich has the story from Capitol Hill.
The president has asked Congress for $401.7 billion for fiscal year 2005. It's an enormous amount of taxpayers' hard-earned money. Such investments will likely be required for a number of years to come, because our nation is engaged in a struggle that could well go on for a number of years.
Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld addressed the Senate Armed Services Committee to lay out President Bush's proposal to fund the military in 2005, Rumsfeld told the committee that a massive global reshuffling of the U.S. military is needed so to fight the new wars of the 21st century and not the old ones of the 20th century. Included in President Bush's defense spending proposal includes billions of dollars for defense contractors such as Lockheed Martin and Boeing, even while Boeing is still under criminal investigation for a leasing deal struck with the U.S. Air Force last year. Republican Senator John McCain addressed this issue with Rumsfeld.
Does it bother you when there are many members of the Defense Policy and Science Board were lobbying DOD and Air Force officials to approve the lease of 100 Boeing 767. Some of them are mentioned in the Boeing emails: Richard Pearl, Bill Schneider, General Fogelman, Admiral Jeremiah, and Admiral Clements. Doesn't all of this bother you, Mr. Secretary, that this incestuous relationship that went on between Boeing and the United States Air Force and the Secretary of the Air Force in particular and Mr. Samber, that none of these people have been called to account for this kind of behavior?
When I left the Department of Defense in 1977, I made it a point not to be connected with anything related to the Defense Department that was for profit. I did it so that I could always feel I could say whatever I wanted on a defense issue and not have someone do what you just did and suggest that simply because I was connected to a defense company. Therefore, what I said might...
I'm not suggesting, Mr. Secretary. I'm telling you that Mr. Clements, who was on your board, had ghostwritten by Boeing an article praising the tanker lease.
I understand what you said, and I say we are looking into those things.
The hearing was slated to be on the 2005 defense budget, but it quickly turned into a hearing about the faulty information that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction before the U.S. invasion. It was the first time Capitol Hill lawmakers publicly asked top administration officials about it. Ranking Democrat on the Senate Armed Services Committee Carl Levin asked Rumsfeld why he publicly said he knew with certainty that Iraq had the weapons, even when the Defense Intelligence Agency, the Department of Energy, and U.N. inspectors presented information to the contrary.
I have relied not on any one single intelligence entity like the DIA or the CIA. I've relied on the intelligence community's assessments, and the intelligence community's assessments were what they were, and they were as I stated them.
Do you see a difference between saying with certainty that we know something and saying that there is some evidence of something?
I do.
That was not the way in which the public statements of the administration were.
Senator Ted Kennedy followed Senator Levine's lead and asked Rumsfeld about his assertion that he even knew where the weapons were.
And then you say in March 03, we know where they are. We know where they are. That is an extraordinary leap. And that extraordinary leap was wrong.
You've twice or thrice mentioned manipulation. I haven't heard of it. I haven't seen any of it, except in the comments you've made. I think I remember, the moment I said we know something, and it was this. The forces had gone in out of Kuwait into Iraq, and they were moving up, and they had gotten in a day or two, possibly, and they were a long way from Baghdad. And as everyone on this committee will remember, the suspect sites for, which is what they generally call them, for WMD, that the intelligence community produced, the suspect sites tended to be north, and they tended to be in the Baghdad and north area. Our troops were a long way from even Baghdad. And I was asked, where's the weapons of mass destruction? And I may have said, I think I said, we know where they are. They're up north. They're not down here. And I was referring to the suspect sites. And you're quite right. Shorthand, we know where they are, probably turned out not to be exactly what one would have preferred in retrospect.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. I just say that in your September 19, 2002 testimony to the committee, you said five times that Iraq has, or we know they have, weapons of mass destruction.
I'm not going to go back and quote the comments from the previous administration and President Clinton and Vice President Gore,
Secretary Cohen,
and all of that the way you have.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Cesarich on Capitol Hill.
UN Secretary General Kofi Annan met with President Bush yesterday, where the two agreed on an interim plan for UN involvement in Iraq. Annan said the US-led occupying forces and the US-appointed Iraqi Governing Council indicated they would accept the conditions under which the UN team will work. The conditions in Iraq have far from stabilized. The death toll from the weekend's suicide attacks on Kurdish officers in northern Iraq rose to 101 yesterday. Many Iraqis are growing impatient as the security problems in Iraq are worse by the day, and foreigners, especially from neighboring countries, are being linked with various political and religious parties that are capitalizing on the continued state of lawlessness. Ahmed Al-Rawi, FSRN correspondent, reports from Baghdad.
Iraqi Kurds and Shiites were extremely happy to get rid of Saddam due to the persecution they suffered during his regime. Most Iraqis hoped that the so-called New Iraq would be an advanced state in a couple of months, equal to the pace of occupying it. But now, Iraqis are looking back towards the past as better life when compared to the current period. Ali Hikmet, a 30-year-old man who works in the food ration system shops, believes that Iraq was better before the American occupation.
It is because there used to be security. People would go out to hospitals even at 3 o'clock at night. Now if you go out at 11 o'clock at night, you cannot provide security to yourself. Electricity, for example, Saddam Hussein used to cut off electricity in the worst cases for 6 hours a day. Now it's cut off for at least 12 hours a day. There was no fuel shortage. Now you wait in the queue for 5 hours in order to fill your car. Concerning water, these days water is being cut for several hours a day, unlike in the past. Gas tubes reached a very high price to about 6,000 dinars, whereas they used to be sold for 350 dinars. Oil prices reached 7,000 dinars, while its price was 200. Even the livelihood was better before because whatever you do now, you cannot fully earn your living.
Bahar Behjet is a 29-year-old owner of a CD shop in Baghdad. He had a somehow different view.
Security about the terrorists act, it is not good. It is still, there are gaps in security. They're killing the teachers and the doctors that are served in during the period before the war. If we come to the public services is getting better in some fields. Other fields, not. If we come to the electricity, there is no change at all. Before the war, the electricity was, I think, better. Communications, it is better. We got mobile telephone, we got satellite receivers, but not everything.
And Ahmed Al-Hashimi, a 26-year-old Iraqi musician and computer science student, has this interpretation of the situation in Iraq.
Well, if you talk about security, it was, you can say it was better before. But not in total yet. There was specific layers of the society were really hurt by the former government. But these days, you cannot say that I'm safe here. You know, when you go to college, when you go to work, you're always got this kind of worry inside. You will get hurt or something like this. These things, now everyone is complaining about. I guess it's just the price for this semi-freedom that we have now. I'm really not worried about security now or the public services or things like that. I'm really worried about the future for my children, for your children. The Americans cannot give us our freedom. No one can give us our freedom. We should take our freedom, and we should pay that price for it. This country needs to be rebuilt. Our people are tired. We had enough. We really had enough.
The unified voice of local Iraqis is that you can't win their hearts and minds without the use of tanks and military helicopters, but rather through independence and a sovereign state. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ahmed Al-Rawi in Baghdad.
Amnesty International reported today that there are massive human rights abuses still occurring in the Sudan, despite the fact that a peace deal to end Africa's longest war is close to being signed between the Sudan government and the SPLA rebels of Colonel John Garang. The meeting between the government and the rebels in the Kenyan town of Naivasha has led to agreements on some of the sticky issues, like the sharing of the country's oil wealth found in the south, and the granting of some limited autonomy to southern Sudan for a period of 6 years before a referendum may create an independent state for black Christians. If the current deal is closed, the rebel leader, Colonel John Garang, could become the vice president of the country he has fought for years to save. FSRN's Joshua Kalimpa has visited southern Sudan and reports about the hopes and fears of the people there.
In this rebel-controlled town of Nimule in southern Sudan, civilians gathered to receive food supplies from relief organizations. They have been displaced by a 20-year-old civil war between the Muslim Arab North, backed by the Sudan government, and the Black African Christian South. On January 7th, the two sides signed an agreement to share all wealth and tax revenues for the southern states, shared between both sides. Many local Sudanese have doubts about the end to the civil war due to the continuation of violence. Liek Ball is the camp commander of this camp.
There might be no a peace between SPLA and Sudan government. They are very serious now, fighting with the people in the western Sudan, bombarding the local civilian.
Russian-made government Antonov fighter planes hover the skies as they go for missions in the far western Sudan, where fighting has intensified in recent months. Last week, several civilians were killed as a result of Sudanese planes bombing of the Chadian-controlled town of Al-Taina. Since fighting has intensified, more than 100,000 refugees flee into Chad. Residents here say this is a common occurrence that dates back a long time.
My name is Deng Ardeng. I come from Abyei in southern Sudan. Yeah, people are forced to leave their home either as a result of bombardment by the Sudanese Air Force or as a result of incursion by Arab militias to most of the part of northern Bahr Ghazal.
If peace is to come, I think people can try to work hard to get for themselves food.
We in the camp, we are hoping for the peace so that we go back home.
Abyei, Blue Nile State, the Nuba Mountains, and Darfur are the three key areas still to be decided in future talks. The SPLA say they should be part of the autonomous south, but the Sudan government disagrees. Samson Kwaje is the spokesperson of the Sudan People's Liberation Army.
Historically, the Nuba Mountains and southern Blue Nile or the Funchal region are part of northern Sudan, but like the south, they have been marginalized in terms of development, and they are African, so they have joined the SPLA, which is more southern, to fight for their rights. Our solution in the issue of southern Blue Nile and southern Kordofan, they should get a high degree of devolution of powers, of autonomy. The population should be consulted whether they want to continue with that degree of autonomy or those arrangements, or they like to improve on it. This is our position.
Under the current agreements, the man who has been leading the SPLA rebels, Colonel John Garang, is due to become vice president in a power-sharing government. The key incentives held out to the government in Khartoum are the lifting of American sanctions and the removal of Sudan from Washington's list of states it regards as sponsors of terrorism. The Bush administration considers Sudan to be a key element in the war on terrorism. Currently, the U.S. maintains counterintelligence operations in Afghanistan, the Arab Gulf, the Horn of Africa, Liberia, Colombia, and Guantanamo Bay. Another big reason for America's interest is Sudan's recently developed oil wealth. Currently, China's CNPC, India's ONGC, and Malaysia's Petronas are investing billions of dollars into oil exploration. European and Western investors pulled out due to pressure from human rights groups. Magid El Naim, Executive Director, Kyle Institute for Human Rights Studies.
All those arrangements can offer a step for peace. But to build peace itself, it is not a matter of putting Garang as a vice president or allocating 50% for oil to the south. It's okay, these are good steps. But we need also to combat the culture of war.
Much of Sudan's oil lies in the south, and existing fields straddle the north-south divide, so full exploration by Western companies means an end to the war and a stable government. Special envoys from the United States, Britain, Italy, and Norway have been active behind the scenes alongside African mediators at the Marathon Sudan Peace Talks. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Joshua Chalimpa in Kampala, Uganda.
The luggage of a Russian theater troupe touring in New Mexico caused the closure and evacuation of Albuquerque International Airport last week. From Albuquerque, Joe Gardner-Wesley reports.
A performance by Ake Russian Engineering Theater is difficult to describe, even for the theater director who brought them to the United States.
It's a very imagistic theater, using a lot of video, a lot of visual techniques of storytelling, and sort of a how can I say it, almost surrealistic and also abstract look at the inner workings of the mind.
Joe Pache of the Tricklock Theater Company invited the Aké Theater to perform their show White Cabin after meeting them in Prague last year. The troupe from St. Petersburg came to be a part of the 4th annual Revolutions International Theater Festival in Albuquerque and to teach university students about different theater methods. Four members of the troupe were leaving from Albuquerque International Airport Thursday when checks by X-ray and bomb-sniffing dog led to their detention and the partial closure of the airport.
The dogs that sniff bags, etc., sniffed out some of the residue from the very mild fire stuff that they use in Ake's performance on stage. And it was like lantern oil residue, it was candle residue, matches, there was lighters, things like that, all in one box. Also with some little theatrical devices that have wires on them.
With that, part of the airport was closed and evacuated for several hours. Agencies like the FBI, the ATF, TSA, U.S. Customs, and INS took the four members of Aké to the press room for interrogation and later to an INS office for electronic fingerprinting. The story immediately hit the news, and Pache headed to the airport as their sponsor. He says the troop members felt very confused.
They were, I think, a bit embarrassed by sort of just having thrown that stuff in their bag and not thinking about it. They were a little embarrassed, but I think also they were a little amazed. One of the comments was, I didn't really think this would ever happen to me in America. And I think that, you know, that came from, and another thing they said was, you know, we grew up under the KGB and being searched all the time, so it's not a new thing for us. But the stereotype of America is that that kind of thing doesn't happen to you.
You know, we need to be cautious how we use profiling.
Brigadier General Annette Sobel is Director of Homeland Security for the state of New Mexico. She reports to Governor Bill Richardson.
You know, the governor has clearly come out against things such as the Patriot Act, and clearly in my capacity supporting the governor, I support, you know, his intent. However, you know, profiling is a very complex issue. What was done here was not profiling. It clearly was, there was a concern on X-ray, there was a concern from the investigative animal that's on site there, and it was just substantive, objective evidence.
For a while on Thursday, security was notched up around the state, particularly at the state legislative session in Santa Fe. On Friday, the performers were able to leave without incident. Joe Pache points out that putting on shows with international performers has become increasingly difficult recently.
And only time will tell if Tricklock is able to get visas again to bring in artists, or if Aké can get visas to come to the United States again.
Around the U.S., there are more postponements and cancellations as foreign artists, musicians, and actors have to wait for clearance from various government agencies. Pache notes that two Arab-Israeli actors could not join their company during this year's Revolutions Festival. They were replaced at the last minute by local university students.
The only story I could get from INS and from the embassy in Tel Aviv was that their names just simply were so similar to other names that were on a list, but that there was no other reason. They're just their name, the spelling.
The Aké Russian Engineering Theater troupe is now touring in Italy. FSRN tried to reach them by email, but was unable to get a response before broadcast. An FBI agent visited the Tricklock Theater's office on Friday to check visa paperwork for visiting groups. Joe Pache says all the agents he dealt with were very professional and polite. In Albuquerque, for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Joe Gardner-Wesley with technical support from Mark Seawards.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations WBAI in New York, KPFA in Berkeley, and KPFK in Los Angeles, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. FSRN is a worker-run collective. For more information, you can visit our website at www.fsrn.org.